I'm less sure of where to look now that we don't have cameras around. So if you see me gazing around, it's because I want to make sure that those who are watching via Zoom are feeling that we remember they're there and we're glad they're part of our community. Other than that, I'm very tempted to say something along the lines of, I'm ready for my close-up, Mr. DeMille. But anyway, as we carry on through these new and interesting times, I have had this week some rather grand experiences. We had some very profound and important experiences in this last week when we said goodbye to two of the stalwarts of our community, Elizabeth and Jesse, in the services that we held here. But I also got to see something of the big old celebrations of pomp and ceremony that the Anglican Church does so well. The investiture yesterday of those who were welcomed into the order of the Diocese of British Columbia, including our very own John McLaren, very well-deserved recognition of all that John has done within our community over many years. So we were very pleased to be a part of that. And Dr. Bonnie Henry receiving an honorary officership within the order as well was a wonderful touch on behalf of the bishop and the synod office and the order itself, recognizing all that she has done for us as a province. Anyway, and there was also the installation, I've got to remember, the installation and collation service on Friday, where we installed canons and collated archdeacons for our diocese, which does sound something like a big office supply event. But it was, again, another one of those ceremonies, and there was beauty and color and music and life, and it was very enjoyable. But between all these events, I have been rereading, or rather re-listening this time, because I bought it on audiobook so I could listen to it as I drive and use transit. I've been listening to Sir Terry Pratchett's book, Pyramids, part of his Discworld series. And it's, like all of Terry Pratchett's books, a wonderful observation on the way that we live life together, more often than not dysfunctionally. And in this, the new king of this ancient realm, which sounds somewhat like Egypt and has a big thing for pyramids, is particularly frustrated when he's asked by the chief priest to hold court and offer his wise judgment on a number of the inhabitants of the land who come to him in fear and trembling, waiting for the word of the king. And Tepic, the king, tries so hard to be fair and just. And every time he makes a pronouncement, all the assembled court turn to the high priest, the chief priest, who completely turns the judgment around and does it all in favor of the religion of the land. There's always sacrifices and money to be given to the temple instead of what the wise king is trying to do. It's frustrating and incredibly insightful, because it's an example, I think, of how an institution can take the genuine good wishes of those within it and twist them around to suit the institution. So those who seek to be honest and just are often lost within the wave of an institution trying to preserve itself, trying to keep things as they are or as they have been. And I'll say why I think that fits with my experiences this week in a moment, but I guess you can think of the threads I'm starting to pull at. But we're going to return to the story, the myth, the fable of Job. We actually had two quite distinct parts in today's reading that Judith read for us. We had, you could see by the layout on the page, the poetic bit at the end where Job is responding to God's voice out of the whirlwind, and then we have the happy ending, which is all in prose, and the long list of things that Job got to kind of make up for all the bad stuff that had happened to him. And many scriptural commentators point out that that prosaic bit at the end isn't there from the original story. It's a tack on at the end. It didn't have the neat little bow that ties everything up and gives everyone a very, very happy ending, apparently. Nor, in all likelihood, did the book have the opening scene with the court of heaven and Satan given permission to test Job to see if he would remain faithful even through adversity and disaster. Poor, blameless Job, set up by the Lord. That's probably not original. And as I was listening to the struggles of a new king to make fair judgment and being overruled by the chief priests of the land called Djeli Baby, which means child of the river Djeli, as I was listening to him being overruled, I couldn't help but wonder if that's exactly what happened in the book of Job, where the institutional editors got to the end of the book and said, that's not very satisfying. We need a happy ending so people know that being faithful, going to temple, and not forget paying your temple tax, all seems like a good idea, even in the midst of struggle. Anything for the sake of a quiet institutional life. Without the framing of the court of heaven at the beginning and the happy ending to finish the book, Job is profoundly honest and vulnerable about how suffering doesn't make sense. And it's a struggle, an honest struggle with the reality of suffering. Why does it often seem to be the case, as the psalmist and Jeremiah say, do the wicked prosper and good people seem to suffer? The heart of the book of Job does not give any easy answers and ends with Job seeming to accept the reality of suffering in that poetic part that we heard today. Although, as seems common with the Hebrew scriptures, it depends what tone of voice you read it in. As John Thetamanil pointed out at Sermon Circle the other day, you can almost hear the sassiness in Job's voice if you listen carefully. The sort of, oh, I know that you can do everything, God. I know that you have created everything, without ever really coming to a place of being obsequious. He may actually be answering God back, as is so much at the heart of Hebrew tradition, a genuine wrestling with the divine. The text doesn't make it clear, and I'm going to leave you to ponder that one even further. But institutions don't like loose ends or unresolved questions. Whether it's government or church or business or the military or whatever, open-endedness is not considered an institutional virtue. People who have questions might not do what you want them to. They might not fill up the collection plate. Please don't feel you need to rebel against that one. They might not pay their taxes, or they might not obey orders. In worst case scenarios, they might have revolutions or do away with the institutions altogether. Yet faith is unresolved. I'm pretty sure the most dangerous and disturbing types I meet are those whose faith has transmuted into some kind of white-hot institutional certainty, an orthodoxy by which everything is measured and judged and more often than not found wanting. Those for whom loyalty to their institution means that any critique of those institutions is heresy or apostasy, both of those I've been called while standing at the garden door at various times, blasphemy, or should be punished or ignored. Sometimes the latter is worse. And it seems we get an echo of that in today's gospel story as well. Bartimaeus calls out and is shushed by the crowd. I think shushing is a way of preventing the present order from being upset. Take, for example, the indigenous peoples of these lands, or those who have advocated for safe substance distribution, or those who speak out against the way in which capitalism makes people expendable, or products, or consumers, anything but fully human. All these voices are pushed down and ignored. As Arundhati Roy writes, there's really no such thing as the voiceless. There are only the deliberately silenced or the preferably unheard. But Bartimaeus shouts louder and is brought to Jesus, where he gets to make his request for sight. Now, There, as a little sidebar, for those who are unsighted, this is a difficult theme that is repeated throughout Scripture, but particularly in the Gospels. The idea of blindness needing healing. Jesus using themes like the blind leading the blind, or people not understanding being called blind, infers that the very fact of being blind is in some way deficiency. There's a very good article that John was very present on Wednesday's sermon circle, shared with us, called An Open Letter from a Blind Disciple to Their Sighted Savior, which looks at this in some depth, and we will try and get the link to that article if you want to follow it up. But it's worth thinking about. If John is watching this online, it will be in the chat by now, the link to this article. But for me, the key to this story is not the healing of Bartimaeus. In the context of our consideration for today, it's he threatens to upset the order of things and he's silenced. Institutions such as the church often feel threatened by an upset to the order. Indeed, there are good reasons why the structures of the Anglican Church have evolved. But as Bishop Anna said to the clergy gathering that we had on Friday, there is no rule that we have as the church that can't, if we need to, be changed. Our previous Chancellor of the Diocese, the late Connie Isherwood, used to lament that the canons were always the first place that people went to, when she said there are actually rules to back us up when we need them, not to turn to immediately in every situation. So you may be saying, what is the upshot of all this musing on institution? Well, the taming of unresolved questions in Job and a fear of open-endedness, the need to reinterpret in the hope of maintaining order that comes from that wonderful Terry Pratchett story, the shushing of voices who call out for justice. Where does this leave us? I mean, we are part of an institution, are we not? We are, in fact, subject to multiple institutional authorities in our daily life. In her sermon at the installation of canons and collation of archdeacons in the cathedral, the dean said, those of us who are most or seem to be most at the heart of the institution are those of us who hold the responsibility for calling the institution to account and for privileging the voices of those who are silenced. We are all part of something which is not inviolable. The church must be constantly reforming, and those of us within must challenge. We must ask questions, and we must refuse to be silenced. We should be actively listening to, encouraging, and going out to those voices who have been marginalized and ignored over years, if not centuries. We should be privileging not the bastions, whether that be the structures or power holders of our institution, but those who are on the margins and outside. We should be encouraging that ongoing transformation as we remember that we don't exist for the sake of the church, we exist for the sake of the world. We come together with common purpose to worship and learning and to learn, not to bolster up the maintenance of our buildings or to huddle together to protect us from reality, but to gain the energy and inspiration that we need through prayer, worship, companionship, community, learning, communion, sharing in this Eucharist, to see, in order that we might see the world anew and to be those who are engaged in the work of transformation and renewal in our world. Pray it may be so. Thanks be to God.